Today at Reader's Corner, Lindsay Cormack, author of the new book, How to Raise a Citizen and Why It's Up to You to Do It. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today speaks directly to an America in which civic knowledge is alarmingly sparse. In her latest book, How to Raise a Citizen, Lindsay Cormack offers an engaged and practical approach to teaching political issues and the inner workings of the U.S. government. She explains why our schools can no longer be the sites of civic education as they used to be, and provides parents with strategies and necessary know-how to be able to impart these lessons to their children. Lindsay Cormack is an associate professor of political science and director of the Diplomacy Lab at Stevens Institute of Technology. She is the author of Congress and U.S. Veterans, From the GI Bill to the VA Crisis, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, The Hill, and elsewhere. Lindsay Cormack, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here and have the opportunity to talk with you.
Lindsay, if I could ask you a question about the Diplomacy Lab, it sounds like it's somehow related here in terms of our conversation. What is the Diplomacy Lab at Stevens Institute of Technology?
Sure. So the Diplomacy Lab is actually a program that's run by the U.S. Department of State, and they have about 50 schools who are participants in it. And what happens is at the beginning of a school year, they'll send around 200 bids for things that you could teach in class. And it might be like, look, we'd like you to make a database on every sort of police operation that's doing countering violent extremism in the United States. Or, hey, we want you to go study what's happening in Burundi when we look at civil unrest. And we kind of say like, okay, here's what we can do, here's what we can't do. And then in the course of a semester, students get to participate in a real world problem-solving activity that the Department of State has said is like of a priority, but they can't take it on right now. And if you do a really good job, they invite you up to DC at the end of the semester, and you can present it to the people who would actually work on this problem. So it's a really neat program that Stevens has been doing for about 9 years now.
Yeah, that's really cool. I would assume that some of those students find their way into the Department of State permanently, you might say.
Yeah, I think for some, it really opens up their eyes as that's like a potential career path that they maybe hadn't considered prior.
Well, let's get to talking about your book, How to Raise a Citizen and Why It's Up to You to Do It. The you in your subtitle and why it's up to you is aimed at parents. Why parents, when there seems to be an assumption in our political lives that this is a job for schools and teachers?
Yeah, so it is for parents, it's for grandparents, it's for people who are around kids. And the reason that I think it has to fall to these people is that after researching school curricula and the sort of assessments that we have at 8th grade and 12th grade and sort of the knowledge that we have about how young people are able to interact or rather not interact with the government, myself and six research assistants realized that this was going to have to be a book that was dedicated to parents, not to schools, because there's some really hard constraints on getting it done in schools. And I don't know any parents that don't want their kids to be as powerful as possible, as mentally healthy as possible, as successful as possible. And all these things sort of take a little bit more civic know-how than we're able to give in schools right now.
Well, let's talk about what you call the civic know-how crisis. As I understand it or remember it, there was a recent survey by the Annenberg Public Policy Center as evidence of this crisis. Please explain.
Sure. So, I mean, if you look at any sort of survey or assessment of the United States public generally, you will find similar sorts of results where we don't know a lot about our government. We can't name a lot of things about the founders. We lack a lot of constitutional knowledge. And if you look at state and local politics, it's even worse. And so I think everyone sort of knows that we're in a bit of this civic deficit where we just don't really understand what's happening. And we also find similar sorts of things if we assess like eighth graders in the nation's report card, we find that only 23% of them have a proficient understanding of civics. And when we look at like AP US government in 12th grade, we see that on average, our students do very badly on this test, and they score in some of the lowest out of all the AP's tests. So we just know that we have a population that is out of their depth in a lot of ways on political questions, questions of how government works. And it's not surprising that our politics feels and doesn't function that well if we don't really know what's supposed to be happening in the first place.
And I want to spend a little time having you explain some of the details in the earlier part of your book, because I think they're so interesting, and they certainly jibe with my own personal experience. But for example, how much do states vary in the civic requirements that high schools have?
The variation is all over the place. I mean, there are some states that have moved to say, you know, if you're going to graduate from a high school in our state, you will have taken part of the citizenship test that new people would have to become U.S. citizens. There are some states that would say you're going to have this like seal that you've done X many hours of community service. But there's some states that don't require civics at all, and it kind of depends on if a student's going to opt into that or not. We really have 50 different state systems, and they usually devolve those decision makers down to school boards, and oftentimes it just depends on which classroom teacher you got that year as to how much civics someone is going to know. I will say there is one sort of standard style of delivery, which is usually in 7th or 8th grade, students are going to get something like U.S. history or world history or something in the umbrella of social studies. And then we wait again until your second semester of your senior year of high school, and you'll get a class called government, which is like, here's what you need to know to be able to active, like you're going to be voting, here's a little bit of founders, here's some historical trivia. But it's not like any other subject. Every other subject we scaffold from K through 12, and we like build on little building blocks and harder concepts and into advocacy. But for civics, we don't do this. And when we look at how we prioritize different things, for every $50 that gets spent in K through 12 on subjects that are STEM focused, only 5 cents get spent on civics. So the variation is great, but we know that it's underprioritized pretty much everywhere.
I have to say I was somewhat amused when I read the part about who students will find at the head of the classroom in high school when they eventually do get into the government class. Mm-hmm. It's an experience that I personally have felt. And you might share this with our listeners. I'm sure many of them will relate to it as well. It's the way things were done then.
Yeah, so the joke that we kept hearing when we were interviewing teachers was, you know who's going to be teaching government. His name is Coach. And that was true for me as well in my high school. The guy who was coaching football and doing some track and some wrestling, he was also coaching that and teaching government.
How is civics education sidelined by testing today?
Well, I think the sort of big thing that's hard to get this done in schools is we have an obsession, right or wrong, with the ACT and the SAT as sort of the marker of how well a student has done in K through 12, what sort of colleges they'll be eligible to go to, and then an aggregate for a school, you know, like how well all of their students do. And when we look at the stuff that is tested, there is no civics. There are no politics or government pieces of either the SAT or the ACT. And so in an environment where you have, you know, a limited amount of curricular time, the stuff that gets squeezed out is the stuff that's not tested. And so it's not surprising that we have this sort of low level of knowledge, because there's a lot of incentive structures that just don't prioritize it. And testing is one piece of that.
About AP courses, how does civics fare among the AP courses that are taught?
Yeah, thank you for asking this question. This was something that was really eye-opening to me and the research assistants when we did this. So in every state, there are a fleet of advanced placement AP tests and classes that can be offered to students. For AP U.S. government, only about 2% of our high school students ever take this class. So it's not a broad swath of the United States, but it is people who think like, oh, this is interesting, or hey, I think I could do well in this. So it's people who are opting into those sorts of classes. And when we look at their test scores throughout the United States, in nearly every state, the modal score is below a 3. It's a 5-point scaled test, and below a 3 means you don't get any college credit for it. When you line it up against all the other AP assessments, there's about 38 that happen right now, AP U.S. government is traditionally in the bottom 5. Last year, it was the second lowest scoring test. And this is sort of crazy to me, because if we think about it, most of the kids who are going to sit for this are going to live and be U.S. citizens under the power of the U.S. government for the rest of their life. But not everyone's going to go on to be using calculus. Not everyone's using Mandarin or Studio 2. But those are the test scores that like do really well. We have really high placements there. Whereas in AP U.S. government, we really are not doing well.
Well, is that because of the coach that we talked about earlier, or is that because of the just lack of emphasis or lack of priority or the best teachers not in the room? Why would that be?
Yeah, so, you know, it's impossible to say in every setting, but I will say nearly every social studies teacher that we talked to described a lot of their challenges being that it's too much information in too short a time. And so, like for other subjects where you have the ability to get familiar with a concept or even familiar with a vocabulary word, you have such a leg up on being able to apply things in a different way. But a lot of times in the 12th grade, people are learning things for the first time. It might be the first time they've heard the word federalism. They might not really know what a governor does. And so, for a lot of different reasons, but mostly it's because we're just like inexperienced in this topic. It's really hard to get everything done in that last semester. And that's also not to mention that in your second semester of high school, you're not typically in your most receptive brain space. Like you're dreaming about what's next. You know you're going to go on to college or a career or getting out of your house. And so it's just sort of a curious time for us to think like, "Oh, let's make sure we download all this important information into their brains." Their brains aren't receptive to it. And it's much harder because they haven't had this experience earlier on.
And you talk to teachers about this issue of what a challenge it is to teach civics in high school. And they gave you some interesting insights into the difficulty of teaching government, period, in America because of federalism. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean that's something where it's different states get to dictate how long you're going to have time in the classroom, but also increasingly there's limitations on what you will be able to teach or how you're going to be able to approach the topics. And so there's some sort of trepidation that a lot of teachers face. It's like, okay, is this going to run afoul of what our state government says? Is this something where I'm risking my job by talking about it this way? And so federalism is certainly a part of it, but the teachers we also talked to had sort of a more pervasive challenge. Parents are one of the biggest challenges that they have. And what they mean by that is even if they're trying to teach something as simple as there's three branches of government, they might say, Congress is the first branch, it's Article One in the Constitution, there's some historical reasons why it should be over the president. If a child hears that lesson and then goes home to a parent and says, here's what they said. They said Congress is better than the president. That parent might hear, oh, that teacher doesn't like the president. And then they can, email a principal, email an administrator, inflame a Facebook group, or badger the teacher directly. And so there's just like not a lot of great protections for teachers in this space, despite the fact that they do want to teach our kids the basics of government. It's that they run risks in doing so, so they feel constrained by a lot of different things, state level, parental level, curricular choices. There's just a lot of things that make it hard to get it done in schools right now.
You're listening to Lindsay Cormack. She's the author of How to Raise a Citizen and Why It's Up to You to Do It. Well, Lindsay, when I hear you talking as closely as you've come to this issue of teachers concerned about what they're teaching and how it's going to sell back home, I can't help but think of Florida and some of these states that are literally in the process of revising our nation's history on race relations. And boy, now you're talking about teachers really being in a bind. Do they stand up there in front of the class? I think in some of these cases, some of these states, there are criminal penalties attached. I know that's not in your book, but I just have to bring it up because it comes awfully close to what you were just describing as the challenge teachers face.
Yeah, and I don't specifically talk this on, but this is all in the same ecosystem. And Florida has a few pieces of legislation. I think one of them a while ago was called the Stop Woke Activism and Critical Race Theory in Schools. And so that really sort of challenges the way that teachers can touch on these subjects. And it is related in the sense that a lot of our race decisions were governmental, were policy implemented. And so you can't really have a historical and accurate understanding of the United States without this component that is touchy, that is sensitive, that doesn't always feel good, but it's a part of it. And it's not just, some people had some bad ideas or thought bad thoughts. We had policies that made it harder to be an African American in the United States versus anyone else. And so when we say, you can't talk about this in this way, or you can't do anything that makes people feel uncomfortable, then we're really kneecapping our ability to understand our own history accurately.
And just to cover the basics, I never really thought of how many pages it was. And I think you're making a point here that, hey, this is not easy stuff. Share with our listeners what that's all about.
Yeah, so it's not easy stuff, but it's also not impossibly hard. And like if you ever wanted to play a game really well, you would read the rule book. And so I have an entire chapter that's sort of dedicated to here's how you can do this over the 18 years that you have your kids in your house. And it's not, sit them down and quiz them on Article One on day one, Article Two on day two. It's make sure that at some point in your all's family life, there is an opportunity for them to have read the Constitution. And the reason that I think this is important that we have it in our homes is that it's just not being done in schools. I'm with college students all the time right now, and I teach Intro to American Politics, and we spend about 4 weeks reading the Constitution, and for most of them, it's their first time actually getting into the document.
So I'm curious, that Introduction to American Politics that you teach, is that required of all students at Stevens Institute of Technology?
It's not. I wish it was, but our students have a breadth requirement where they can either take Intro to Political Science, Intro to Psychology, or Intro to Sociology. But I do know there are some states that are making moves to say, like, you know, you do have to have one political science class in college. And I think that's actually probably a good move, because for students who don't choose that, for students who choose another track, they are probably never going to have another instructional setting in their life where they're going to talk about government. And instead, they play catch up for like the next 40 years to kind of figure out what's happening on their own.
Well, I have to admit, I was really mining for that answer you gave, because I taught political science many, many years ago, and I started in a community college, and it was required of every student. They had to take Intro to American Politics. And I guess I'm trying to make the point that I don't think that's done in very many places these days. And I think in some cases, faculty have, they played a role in this. I mean, faculty go along with this idea of, oh, let's give students more choices. But it seems to run counter to the point you're trying to make in this book. Why write this book if you're not saying we have to do better here? And I think you've done a great job of helping us with that. Let's get back to parents, though, and the role that they play. Kids are different ages. How do you deal with the fact that, you know, a six-year-old may deserve different treatment when it comes to parental education on civics compared to a 13-year-old?
Yeah. So, I mean, I go through the book and sort of break it out into three age categories. And I think, you know, if you have kids of different ages, then you've been straddling a lot of hard lessons the whole time. You know, you're going to teach them about like safety in cars or safety with strangers or alcohol in different ways. And I think politics can be sort of bundled into that in a similar way. But the thing that I most caution parents about is I want them to feel like they are okay to talk about politics in front of their kids. Because I grew up in Kansas and we did interviews, you know, throughout the United States, and there are different cultures, but in parts of the country, more in the middle than on the coasts, there's sort of this taboo around talking about politics, and it sits in a space where like maybe you don't do it in the same way you don't talk about religion or sex or money. And I think the second thing that I want parents to be aware of is your kids are getting messages about politics even if you're not going to do it. Like if you look at children's literature or children's entertainment, there's sometimes a government official like a mayor. And even in like things like Paw Patrol or The Simpsons, this person is like at best a bumbling doofus, or at worst, they're like out to do harm to the city that they're meant to serve. And so our kids are going to get this negative government messaging. So we need to make sure that we sometimes find the bright spots. Like if you have nice roads, government had a hand in that. If you can drink your tap water, government has a hand in that. If they have playgrounds that they like or schools that they enjoy going to, government is doing some of that work. And so I think something that parents can do to sort of help our politics make it more aspirational is recognize some of the good. Yeah, there's plenty to be frustrated about. There always will be. But there's also so much good that happens in most of our politics. But we just need to make sure that we point that out to our kids so that they can kind of see that as something that's like something to aspire to, not something to think someone else should do or doesn't matter or it's for other people to care about.
And boy, social media is certainly going to give students a dose of government and politics, and probably not in a good way, which leads me to my next question. You say one of the most important things to keep in mind when parents are discussing politics is restraining negativity. Help us with that.
Yeah, I mean, our kids learn from what we do and what we don't do and sort of everything. So if all they hear us saying is, you know, everyone in politics are liars, they're all in it for themselves, they're egomaniacs, the system's rigged, it's all a bunch of cheaters, it's not surprising that they're not going to want to go learn more or lean into that system. And so what I mean by restraining negativity is we need to let our kids know that there is good that happens in government, because there truly is. And it's not to say that we'd never complain in front of them. It's not to say that we don't, you know, say here's a frustration or here's something that can be better. That can be productive. But if that's all they hear, if that's the message that they get in their home, then they're not going to try to lean in and learn more. They're not going to aspire to these things. And so I think as parents, we owe it to ourselves, to our kids, to our communities, to our futures, to kind of re-envision what we think about public service. And you know this probably more than most people. You know, most people who are doing the work at the state level and the local level, they're not in it for themselves. They're in it because they think they have a vision about how things could be better, and no one else is stepping up to do it as well as they can. And I think that's true for most of the people who I meet in elected office at state and local levels. They're trying their best and they're trying to do good by everyone else who they're serving.
Give us some ideas of how, when, and where parents can discuss politics with their kids and hope to have some positive results.
Well, I think the win is an easy one. You know, we only get four or five elections, presidential elections, with our kids until they become voting eligible adults themselves. And so I think these sorts of winnowing focused periods where we have a presidential election is a great time to start to do this work. And I think the request there is that we don't just stop at the presidential election. And when we think about, you know, like what are the policies that are going to happen, that really depends on who wins the House and who wins the Senate. And so it's like being able to go a little bit later, a little bit further into the details and figuring things out with them. As for the how, there's plenty of easy ways to do it. You can take your kids to vote with you. Let them see the sights of power. Let them go understand what that is. Because we know that voting is habit forming and contagious, but you can't catch it unless you've seen it, unless you've experienced it. So I think that's an easy way to do this. I also really like the idea if you have a kid who's like, you know, 12 and up and they're adept on the internet and you have some local elections coming up, you can ask them to be sort of like the family researcher and say like, hey, I don't know much about this city council race. Can you go figure out who you think would be the better candidate? And let them sort of develop that muscle for what it is to make decisions. How do I assess people that are competing for something? There are so many ways that our kids can get involved in these processes, but they're probably not going to think of them on their own. And it does take a little nudging. And the reason that I think parents have to do this nudging is because it's not clear that it's happening anywhere else. And our politics just isn't going to feel or function better if people don't understand it, can't get into the process, and don't care about it. And as for when, you know, and their age, I think there's never too early. You should be able to bring your kids to vote with you at any point where it's, you know, and you know this, people like that. When you go to the polls, the people who are working there, they love to see kids. They love to hand out future voter stickers. And it's a fun sort of way to show them what it is to be an adult, what it is to care about community and do this sort of civic duty.
That reminds me of something you said somewhere in your book about the importance of non-cognitive skills motivating students. What do you mean by that?
So, I mean, you know, we have these non-cognitive skills, which are things that are not like, can we go retrieve this little bit of knowledge that's in our brain? Do I have these facts right? Do I have this process down? These non-cognitive skills are all these other pieces about like, can you be motivated in the face of not having a deadline against you? Do you have the ability to sort of critically assess things? Not necessarily that you're going to get the right answer for a thing, but you can like express opinions, assess other things that people say. Politics is a great training ground for this because, you know, it's historical, it's present, it's future. It's grappling with things that aren't right or wrong. There's sort of like a grittiness to figuring out what's in the gray, what's possible, what's not possible. And we know that when we think about what makes kids successful, it's not just do they have the ability to retain information and recall it on command. It's also can they grapple with things that are in the gray? Can they stay motivated to care about something? Can they stretch themselves to care about things that they maybe haven't thought about before? Those are all those sort of non-cognitive things that can be developed by talking about politics and advocacy.
So your focus tries to stay clear of, I guess, what is the major challenge of the moment. And that's the fact that you're addressing this book to parents, some of whom are having trouble getting the truth right themselves, distinguishing fact from fiction. I know that, you know, you don't want to write a book that only aims at one political party or one group of parents who believe one way versus the other. But how do parents deal with this? I mean, there is a fact issue here at some point that is more important than whether or not they know that there are three branches of government.
Yeah, how do you get to accurate information? That's certainly a hard one because something that I sometimes get pushed back for is people are like, well, if the parents aren't figuring it out, how are they supposed to teach the kids? And I sort of want to offer like a little grace here because people who are parenting today were raised in systems that were already actively deprioritizing civics education. And so this effort is not really like finger waggy or scoldy to be like, hey, you guys don't know enough, go learn more. But it's really meant to be hopeful in the sense that like, yeah, we don't know as much as we probably should. But guess what? We're the adults in the room now and we get to change that thing. And so figuring out, you know, what the truth is something that should be valuable to you. Figuring out facts that allow you to live your life with more clarity should be valuable to you. And when we think about partisanship, you know, it's really not a book that's like, here's how to raise little Republicans or here's how to raise little Democrats. And the reason for that is twofold. One is I don't much care. I think, you know, it's much more important that we have little citizens who understand the rules and we trust that they can figure out whatever the party is that makes sense for them. Right. But the other reason is The emerging research on the ability for parents to transmit their own partisanship to their kids is mixed at best. Like, it's about a coin toss as to whether you can successfully turn your child into the partisan identification that you have. And then about 50% of the time, you get someone who either opts out or they pick the other party. And so I don't even think it really should be a goal in one's mind. And if you get, you know, maybe you were raised as a Republican and then, you know, your kids decide they want to be Democrats. That's not a failure. That's a success. That's a marker of a house that has enough love and enough embrace of different opinions to have people who see the world differently, which we all sort of do. So I think I understand these are hard problems. These are big problems. They're problems of our moment, but they shouldn't be inhibiting. They're things that we can get over and we kind of have to because there's no one else coming to fix this for us. It's up to us.
Right, right. You know, as a former political science professor, I still remember the stories of the accusations that were leveled at those of us in the classroom that somehow we were changing the views and the attitudes of their young people. When they left high school and they were under our control, they were okay. Now you guys got a hold of them, turned them all into liberals. And I never really understood that because I didn't see that very often. I would see students who seem to pretty much stick to their parents' political affiliations or views, whatever you want to call them. I think there's even some research that's been done on this. I don't have it at the tip of my tongue, but again, I'm not so sure that we in the academy have that much control over how a student's eventually going to look at government or teaching, except of course how you're doing it. You want to make sure they understand the system, and that's one thing. Then how they come down on it politically, that's something that's theirs, right?
Yeah, I think that is theirs. And I think I sort of share that with you. By the time we get them, you know, in higher ed, they're mostly fully formed. We're doing the polishing. We're not like doing the forging. That's pretty much already happened. And I think when we do talk about like the liberalizing influence of higher education, I don't think it's typically transmitting ideas from professors to their brains and liberalizing them. It is probably the liberating feeling of living amongst other people that you otherwise wouldn't have when you were younger. That is probably what we mean by liberalizing, is you're just experiencing the world in a different way because you're forced to reckon with people who didn't grow up in the same place, same everything as you.
So how long have you been out talking about this book? What kind of reaction you've had from folks that you've been able to discuss this with?
So I've been bouncing around the country since the beginning of September, really. And I've been talking to, like, I know it's been very fun. I've been talking to church groups and historical societies and lawyers and PTAs and parent salons and library groups and Leagues of Women Voters and that sort of stuff. Most people are very receptive to the message. They are a little scared to enact it themselves. And so when we meet, like, in those in-person settings, I always sort of leave people with, like, the push is, like, you can do this because you can do this. I can't really think of one that's more valuable than how can you be effective, politically rooted, and understand the system that you're in. Because when we think about a lot of things that plague our kids, some of it's like hopelessness or apathy or fear of the future or uncertainty, and all those things are going to be true forever. But if you understand your government, if you know what the limits of power are, if you understand what levers to pull on, if you need to get something to change, you are that much more effective as an adult. You are that much more mentally clear because you can understand when someone's trying to deceive you, if it's misinformation or a stretch of a truth. And I think that giving these gifts to our kids is something that allows them to live better lives in every other single way because they don't have these fears that might be unfounded, but we can prey on them now because we simply don't know enough.
Well, parents have struggled for years trying to teach their kids the dangers of drugs, for example, and teaching them the basics of civics and government seems like easy lifting compared to the challenges parents have faced in the past, especially these days, when it comes to drugs. So to your point, and you, by the way, I should let you comment on the last third of your book, because you give parents who buy this book what they need. If they took an American government course 20 or 30 years ago and they're a little rusty, you've done a great job in the last third of your book in laying it all out for them. Here's how you do this.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's sort of my primer, because that's an acknowledgement that I know people who are picking this up aren't necessarily interested in this topic inherently. A lot of times they might feel out of their depth. And so that last third is just sort of like, here's a little bit to get you started. It's not, you know, like you're going to get drilled down into trivia bits, but it's pretty accessible. And so I really liked writing that part.
Yeah.
And I think one of the great things about being a professor at an engineering school is I oftentimes have to communicate ideas to people who are not specialists. Like
that's
that is
right.
That is just the reality that I'm in. And so I think that was a good training ground for this sort of exercise.
Well, it sure is, and you've done a great job of it. It's called How to Raise a Citizen and Why It's Up to You to Do It. The author is Lindsay Cormack, who we've been talking to. Lindsay, thanks for writing the book. Thanks for being with us here at Reader's Corner, and the best wishes for a future explaining how we can all become better citizens. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.